Boom, drum, boom, cling. Boom, drum, boom. Bow, bow, bow. Bow, 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 bow,
bow, bow, bow, bow, bow, bow, bow, bow, bow, bow, bow, bow, bow, bow, bow, bow, bow, bow, bow, bow, bow, bow, bow, bow, bow, bow, bow, bow, bow, bow, bow, bow, In the year, I don't know what's been going on with you. I forgot how to speak English.
You spent a lot of time in that embryo room. I told you not to spend so much of the year in the embryo room.
Well, I really wanted the podcast to mirror the production of The Prisoner. So I insisted that we create the episode about Once Upon a Time as though it were going to be the end of a first season.
Mm-hmm.
It was going to be a season one finale. And then we would have another 13 episodes to go. But as you know, Lou Grade, who produced at ITV, who produced this thing, said, I don't want two 13 episode seasons. America, CBS, who's buying this, doesn't want 26 episodes of anything. So we're going to do 17 episodes. So after they did the first 13 episodes, concluding with Once Upon a Time, designed originally to be a season one finale, or series one finale, as they say, mm-hmm. in the UK. Then Patrick McGoohan went and made Ice Station Zebra, or Zebra, as they say, in the UK. They say things. They pronounce season series.
Mm-hmm.
They pronounce Omnibus Lorry.
Omnilorry.
Omnilorry.
Well, lorry's more of a truck, I guess.
Can I just say something? Look. It's a problematic fave, to be sure. They're a lot worse. There's some social attitudes and friends, particularly around the LGBTQ plus everything else community, that do not hold up. But there's some pretty solid comedy on that show. And I was reminded by our son, who publicly is known as Hodge Manillo. He's a big Joey fan. Joey is the best friend.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean?
Yeah, and Ross is the worst.
Oh, yeah. How did we not know that? Why was anyone rooting for Rachel to get with Ross?
It was a different time. It was a very different time.
Right. It was just like, oh, well, here's the boy. You have to root. And he wants the girl, so he should get the girl.
Yeah.
That was the attitude of all boys at all times. Apparently. And we all went along with it, even though he was, what they call now, toxic, terrible person. Joey, the best friend forever. And there's this Ross and Joey joke. And it's an Omni joke. That's why I thought of it. Ross says to Joey, "Joey, what would you ever do if you were omnipotent?" And he would say, "I'd probably kill myself." And Ross is like, "Why?" And Joey says, "Well, I mean, if there was nothing for little Joey to do, why did I have any reason to live?" Because he thought he meant...
Impotent. Yeah.
Impotent. Impotent. And Ross goes, so that's pretty funny.
Mm-hmm.
And then Ross goes, no, Joey, omnipotent. And Joey goes, you are? I mean, what a day in the writer's room that must have been. When they joked on that joke.
Mm-hmm.
A joke and a joke. It's what I learned from The Daily Show. You were the head writer of The Daily Show.
For a little bit, yeah.
There was always a little hesitancy. Do we joke a joke? Do we add a joke? That would be a tag, I think.
That's more of a tag, as opposed to a joke on a joke. Or as they say in Los Angeles, a hat on a hat.
Hat on a hat.
In the East Coast, it's a joke on a joke. And in West Coast, it's a hat on a hat.
I love a hat on a hat. You know what? I want a hat on a hat on a hat, and I want to hang a lantern on it. It's writer's room comedy. What fun they must have had when they came up with that.
What was it
no,
like?
No, Joey. Omnipotent. You are? It's great. It's great.
I'm sure it was just as fun in the prisoner writer's room, sitting around, coming up with jokes for number six and number
sure.
two and
they
all their pals.
So much fun. That was well known as a very fun room, particularly when they were writing this episode, Fallout.
Mm-hmm. And by they,
which is just,
you mean Patrick McGoohan.
Patrick McGoohan by himself in a sub basement, I'm sure, of his own, at least mentally, maybe physically too, I don't know.
So I've seen two different stories about this. One that,
okay.
as you said... Once Upon a Time was meant to be a season finale and then they cut it back and they said, no, we'll do 17. So you have to do quickly a couple other episodes. And
you have to come up with four
and
more
a series
episodes.
Finale. But
including a series finale.
But Patrick McGoohan would always say that he wanted to do 7 episodes. He wanted to be a miniseries. And that he was told, if we do 17 episodes, we can sell it as a season to America.
So
I don't know which of those two stories. That might be Patrick McGoohan trying to save face. I don't know. I don't know which is the true story.
What I read was that Patrick McGoohan wanted to do 7 episodes,
mm-hmm.
or installments, as they say in the UK. Programs.
Of this program spelled with 2 M's.
Yes, exactly. And an E.
Mm-hmm. And an E.
Lou Grade at ITV had an offer from CBS to air. Lou Grade wanted to sell it to the United States, so he wanted to make 26, which was the standard season of television in the United States.
Can you imagine? That was back when you could really live off writing a TV show. 26 seasons.
26 episodes.
None of this. Holy. 10 episodes for a season, and we're going to write it in a mini room. We're going to break the episodes into mini rooms. So you work for 4 weeks, and the creator of the show will go off and write the episodes. What a terrible system.
Yeah, this is called Joking the Joke. It's a podcast about...
about the problems. This is a...
About the horrible torture it is to be imprisoned in a writer's room where you're responsible for 2 to 3 lines of a script and then you take a break every 35 minutes to get subs.
It's pretty true. Anyway, sponsored by the Writers Guild of America West, this is Joking the Joke.
Well, and the East.
And the East.
It's the East also.
Yeah.
Yeah. I'm out here repping the WGA East. I don't know... This is the classic WGA East Coast, West Coast rivalry. people have gotten hurt.
Yeah.
People have gotten hurt.
It's been
hurt.
Dangerous. We got to stop the violence. Start the silence.
Whatever happened, Patrick McGoohan, first there were going to be 26 episodes. Then CBS said, we don't want that many. Give us 17 is what they settled. Anyway, they made 13. Once Upon a Time was shot and finished.
Yes.
When Patrick McGoohan went off to film Ice Station Zebra. Then all of a sudden gets a call saying, we got to make 4 more episodes, including a series finale.
And you have weeks to do it.
So Patrick McGoohan said, I will do it. And he took Once Upon a Time and made that the first of a 2-part season/series finale.
Well, series, and now
season
in the way that...
Season/series/programmy finale.
I was going to say, now it's not just a series finale in the British sense, but also in the American sense, and that is the end of the series. There's no more episodes.
Final finale.
Yeah.
Final finale is what the working title of this episode. And he had to do it in weeks. And like other people who had written Puzzle Box shows... set on a contained, I'm not going to name names, but other people who had written puzzling mystery shows set in a contained world that where things got weirder and weirder and everyone was going to like, how are they going to wrap it up? Patrick McGoohan, I believe, has acknowledged he didn't really know.
That's what he said, is that when he started the show, at least, he did not know who #1 was going to be. That there was no, right. He had no end in sight. And why not? Because his previous show, Danger Man, which was also an espionage show, there was no overarching mystery, so you could just go on and do that forever. I think
he
didn't have... It was like, well, my last show, I didn't need to know how it ended, so why do I need to know how this one ends to start it? I got 26 episodes, baby!
Right. So I guess... So a year later, he had finally wrote this script in 4 weeks, this follow-up to Once Upon a Time, which was our last episode on this, our podcast, which we'll introduce in a moment. And then he had 4 weeks to write this episode. He's like... How can I make what I did in Once Upon a Time even weirder and also a musical? This is Be Podding You, a very short podcast about some of the episodes of the British science fiction programmy called The Prisoner. I am Number John, a prisoner of this podcast, not a free man. And you are Number Elliot?
I'm Number Elliot, a.k.a. Elliot Kalin, a semi-free man. I have 2 children that are constantly demanding my attention, who has been a longtime fan of this series and has watched this episode in particular multiple times.
Multiple times.
Multiply times, as they would say in England.
And as I have not seen it since probably I was in high school. And as I mentioned in our last episode 1 year ago, I misremembered it dramatically.
I'm very curious, what was your memory of what it was? Before we get into the real episode, what was your memory like?
My memory... So first of all, I put those weirdo goggles...
In this episode. The ones from last episode. Okay.
Yeah. And probably this was like because... a lot of people see these 2 episodes being one long episode.
Mm-hmm.
we do follow directly after. At the end of Once Upon a Time, number six has defeated his old foe, number two, to death. And is being shown, has asked to see, to meet number one. And they go, he and the supervisor go in an elevator, and they go deeper and deeper into the bowels beneath the village to the sub basement, and arguably meets number one. We'll get to that in a moment. It's a direct follow-up. And so probably during my research of every now and sort of like 2 a.m. curiosity, what was that about again? I always remember seeing the picture of McGoohan in those goggles, and I put that on the very end
of
the final episode. I really have a very distinct memory of the scene towards the end when all of the village goons, all of the village sub-basement goons are crowded into this hallway, having to run down this hallway.
Some of them on motorcycles.
Some of them on weird little like motorcycles. They look like they work for DoorDash.
Yeah.
Because they're on these little motor scooters. And a lot of them wearing these weird scuba suits. And all of them are wearing goggles.
Mm-hmm.
And just like this claustrophobic, crushing, and here I'm going to say a swear word, mindfuck. Both, that was the vibe that I had. Just like a mash of visual weirdness that was non-narrative, which is sort of true, but not, less true than I thought.
Mm-hmm.
And just like a surreal collage of sound and fury. Mm-hmm. Signifying nothing, to quote Shakespeare, or Shakespeare-y, or St. John, as they call him in England.
as they call him in England, Telly.
St. John Rhys Shakespeare-y. And yet, what I discovered was an episode that is certainly surreal, perhaps as abstract as Once Upon a Time, but less reminiscent of experimental theater, boring experimental theater. And more just so flat out weird and visually inventive and odd, even though it takes place and is shot essentially in one set.
Yeah, it's almost entirely in one room. Yeah.
Yeah. And then it ends in a way that I didn't remember at all, and which I found really fascinating and funny and like gratifying and exciting. And not with a kind of like, bleh, it was always thus. Kind of cynical, like, you're all, I mean, there is a little bit of you're all in jail to it.
Yes.
But there's also a lightness to it that is not a part of any other part of the series that I remember.
No, this episode has a sense of joy to it, especially in the end. I find the ending this...
Yeah, the end. That's what I'm speaking of.
Yeah, I mean, I love this. I love this episode, and especially the very end of it, I find so, yeah, like, uplifting to me and so beautiful in a way. Like, I get such a sense of, like, you know, there's a sense of abandon to it that's almost like A Hard Day's Night in a way. And after this, the last episode is so oppressive, the one before this, the previous episode is so oppressive and so intense. And this episode has some of that feeling to it. But then by the end of it, it feels like the show is throwing off the shackles that it put itself in. The show is breaking loose in
a
way
you
wouldn't expect.
Yes, exactly. And, you know, maybe there's an element of Patrick McGoohan being like, I made my own prison and now I got to escape from it.
Yeah, yeah.
Like, that's the show's over. And it does have A Hard Day's Night, and it's not coincidental that feeling comes up because it's, you know, it's got a Beatles song in it.
Yes.
Which is wild that they are able to use
that
song.
Something, well, and we'll talk about it.
They used it at the time, like it was out.
It was it was a newish song. Yeah, well, they play, we'll talk about that scene, but yeah, it's something that's that really strikes you as, All You Need Is Love plays. That was a newish song. And every single time I've seen this episode, whether on DVD, on the Sci-Fi channel, that song has never been cut out when I've seen it. And I'm so used to, you know, people talk about like WKRP in Cincinnati, they have to cut all these scenes, or like Doctor Who, they have to cut all these scenes.
Did you ever wonder whatever became of me? I'm living, you know, that when you say that,
I didn't know you had to sing
those letters. Yeah, it's a curse. A genie cursed me a long time ago.
Or I didn't realize that. I apologize. Yeah. Or that even
an Ohioan genie.
When they released the state
living on the air in Cincinnati.
When they released
Cincinnati WKRP, got tired of them packing.
You're a prisoner of that theme song.
Up and down the dial. Maybe you and me were never meant to be. But baby, think of me once in a while. I'm at WKRP and please don't sue me, ASCAP.
Well, but anyway, you get my thing. That was beautiful. But when the state came out on DVD finally, there were a lot of songs that they had to replace with sound-alikes. And it's always struck me as so strange that I don't know what deal they made for it, but that this Beatles song has always been in this episode. And it's just a very it hits you so hard, I think, because you're not used to hearing the Beatles in stuff unless it's, I mean, now it's not as much, but it's a movie about the Beatles, or it's a movie about how there were no Beatles and now this guy is going to steal all their songs or something, you know.
You're talking about the movie Tomorrow?
Yesterday.
Yeah, that's right. Tomorrow is the sequel, I forgot.
Yeah, Tomorrow is when he wakes up and the Spin Doctors never existed and he steals their songs.
I'm going to say something to you right now that's maybe controversial. The movie Yesterday?
Mm-hmm.
I love it.
Oh, I've never seen it. Is it good?
I love it. You know what it is? I mean, I think a lot of people are like, you know, sentimental. It's like, yeah, a lot of those songs are very sentimental. Like, you know how a lot of, like, spoiler alert, it ends with obladi oblada.
Uh-huh.
Which, you know, John Lennon was like, this is a stupid kid song. I don't want to have anything to do with this. Paul McCartney was like, it's fine. And it's a children's movie. You should watch it with your children.
Okay, maybe I will. I mean, my kids love the Beatles, so.
Yesterday is so much fun.
Okay, I'll have to watch it at some point.
It's great.
So speaking of a show from yesterday, by which I mean yesteryear, by which I mean 1968.
Well, let me just say one thing about Love Is All You Need in this. And it starts, it's right at the beginning of this episode, so it's perfect.
Yeah, it's very early.
And then it comes back, semi-ironically. It's a startling use for the rights usage alone.
Mm-hmm.
I did notice when I was reading about Port Marion, the actual resort village that still exists in northern Wales where this was shot, the exteriors were shot, that George Harrison celebrated his 50th birthday there in 1993.
Oh, interesting. Coincidence.
Aside from the mind love, I'm tired of saying mind fuck, so I'm just going to say mind sex.
That sounds worse somehow.
The mind hugging and kissing that I've been dealing with on the show is like thinking about George. I'm 51. George Harrison was 50 in 1993.
Mm-hmm.
Like the Beatles were 20 years behind him at that point.
Yeah.
And he celebrated his birthday at Port Marion. So maybe the deal is that they have to let, They had to let the prisoner use this music in perpetuity, or else they would never release George Harrison from the village.
But it's possible. Or I thought maybe the deal was that you can use our song, but someday I'm going to come to that village and I want to stay there for my birthday.
Oh, yeah, maybe he got comped.
Yeah.
Maybe he got comped.
Yeah. Yeah,
that's right. That's right. Because, you know, George Harrison, famous for wanting a bargain.
They used to call him
bargain hunter.
They called him the thrifty one.
Yeah.
But it's important that we should mention Port Marion because let's start the episode. We do not get the regular opening credits. Instead, there's a recap of the previous episode. And then the opening credits say shot at Port Marion in Wales. And, or, you know, that doesn't say exactly that. But it's the first time in the whole series that the location has been given a credit. And according to Wikipedia, it says this resulted from an agreement with Port Marion's architect, Sir Clue Williams Ellis, that the location would not be revealed until the series finale. I don't know why the architect would care. But he was Sir Bertram Clue Williams Ellis was a major Welsh architect, like a major, major figure in Welsh architecture, and also a major figure in building preservation in Wales. So,
particularly preservation of traditional village architecture.
Yes.
He was an anti-urbanist, and he felt that urban planning was destroying the culture of small village life, and he created the village or Port Marion as a lifelong project, starting with buying the original estate in 1925 and continuing to add and develop these whimsical buildings from all these different architectural styles, eras, and regions until his, you know, well, until the prisoner was made.
Yeah.
So, you know,
and he managed
40 years.
He managed to do the same thing that often happens with building preservation, where an attempt to preserve a smaller, cheaper lifestyle turns that location into a place only rich people can go to on vacation. So, like George Harrison. But
you can go there. The website is active.
Yeah, I would love to go there.
I didn't check the prices, but you can go there.
If this is a successful enough podcast, we should see if maybe we'll kickstart a live show at Port Marion, and you and me can go there and we'll talk about the other 13 episodes that we didn't talk about.
Well, between 2012 and 2018, there was a number 6 festival at Port Marion, an annual music, arts, comedy, and prisoner festival, or the prisoner TV show festival. It's been on an hiatus now for however many, in the 1921, 4 years. See how bad I am at math. I couldn't figure it out. 4 years. 4 years. More is it subtraction. But like, I think Iron Maiden did a prisoner song.
Yes. Well, they did a song called Back in the Village.
Yeah. Right. But off the top of my head, I can't remember now some of the acts that played there. But the Pet Shop Boys were there.
Oh, wow.
The very funny Irish comedian David O'Doherty performed there.
Oh, wow.
So maybe we can restart that.
Yeah. We could do that. That'd be fun.
Well, let's not get ahead of ourselves. We haven't escaped the prison.
That's true. We're still stuck in the village.
We have one more to do. So take us away. Take us down into that sub-basement number, Elliot.
So number 6, the supervisor and the butler, they have left the embryo room. They're going through the floor to a sub.
Oh, right. I forgot the butler was there too. He didn't get a break at that point.
No.
He just spent a week in a room.
He just keeps going.
He can't get a little lie down.
And they must be so smelly, the two of them, from being in that room for a week.
Did you notice when he's in that elevator going down to the sub basement in that opening scene, he's got a little, number 6 has got a little 5 o'clock shadow, maybe even a number 6 o'clock shadow.
They take him to another sub-basement where they have a mannequin that looks just like him with his old clothes, his pre-village clothes on.
Right.
His dark suit with dark... It's a different dark suit with a dark turtleneck and or dark jacket and slacks. He puts them on, and that's when they walk through a hall of jukeboxes that are all playing All You Need Is Love. And they enter this very Bond villain-esque lair.
Now into James Bond villain lair full of henchmen.
Yes. There's henchmen wearing helmets and with guns in their hands, and there's a jury of people in white robes with masks that are half white and half black, split down the middle, and the masks are. And they each have a label, like a United Nations type nameplate in front of them that say things like identification, security, therapy, nationalism, anti-nationalism. They all have one of those.
The ones that I was able to pick out, and I guess that these are departments of the village?
It's possible. I mean, departments of the village or as my theory would say, departments of the self, the interior self, you know.
But. Well, sure. I mean, we're working on a very allegorical level here.
Yes.
For sure. But the story as it unfolds is still, it's still taking place in the village. And, you know, the overall storyline is that Patrick McGoohan has earned the right to watch the appointment of himself, his inauguration as potentially the new head of the village.
Well, so they're all applauding him, and there's a judge. There's in classic kind of like judge's robe and wig from English.
Which they had just done that in Once Upon a Time. They just had Leo McKern in that same wig and robe.
So it still smells like Leo.
I was just like, come up with a new thing.
But this
have
is,
him wear something else.
This is a different character who's referred to in the credits as president. He's played by Kenneth Griffith.
Right. And he's sort of leading the discussion, and I don't want to lead the discussion, but I just want to say I was fascinated by these little nameplates in front of this tribunal, this large body of white-robed, masked figures.
Mm-hmm.
The ones that I could see were activists and pacifists in the first pass-by, which feels more abstract, like these are different philosophies in the world. But then later I saw defections, therapy, reactionists, and nationalists, and identifications.
Yeah.
So it's abstract, but then it also has a little bit of a bureaucratic, like this is the Department of Therapy. This is the Department of, we deal with people who have defected. We deal with identifying who people are, or whatever it is. I don't know. Everything's a little cuckoo in the village, especially when you get down into the sub-basement. Let's talk about for a second what we got in this cave. First of all, we got, what's the kinds that hang down? Stalactites?
Stalactites.
The hanging down kinds. We had a lot of those. We have this jury / assembly / department meeting of weird white-robed, masked, bemasked figures. that is presided over by this president in his red robe, no mask. We got a purple throne on some purple stairs.
On a raised platform.
We got a couple of cylinders that have people in them, steam holes.
Yeah, they're bobbing up and down above and below the level of the floor with steam coming out of them, with people inside them. Specific people
inside them.
And there's also
specific people who we're going to hear about.
And there's the cylinder that has a big robot eye with a number one painted on the cylinder.
Yeah. And then, speaking of duality, you got that seesaw. A new seesaw.
Yeah, a new seesaw is right there. Yep.
And this seesaw does not have Leo McKern and number six on either end of it. This seesaw doesn't have guys looking into computers, surveilling members of the village on it. This seesaw has two machine guns on either end.
Yeah.
With two machine gunners. That's the first time you see guns in the village, right?
I believe so. Up till now, it's been all karate chops and punches. Right. And I think this is the first episode where you see, like, yeah, guards with guns, where it's no longer, we're keeping you in the village by rover or by confusion. It's like it's James Bond type henchmen, the guys who.
It's truly James Bond.
And
you have to imagine that he was thinking that.
Yes,
to I a have degree, to assume so. Right? Because after all, John Drake, Secret Agent Man, Danger Man, his previous role was developed in the wake of James Bond mania.
Yes. And the idea behind that character was it was going to be like the thinking man's James Bond, you know?
Right.
And so I think you're entirely right that he's playing with those tropes very deliberately, you know? And he said in interviews, like, people assumed it was going to be some kind of James Bond ending. Like, in Wikipedia, they quote him. It says, there are numbers here. There are no names. So you can't expect it to end like James Bond. You have to have an allegorical ending. So he knows he's playing with probably the expectations of the audience that this is going to be some kind of supervillain lair. So this judge, the president, he calls it all to order. He says, number six has proven his right to be an individual by, you know, defeating these tests. And he sits on his throne so he can witness the transfer of ultimate power. There's a ceremony for that. And
he says, by the way, this is going to be a long and tedious process, this transfer of ultimate power.
It takes a long time.
The judge literally says that. Like, they're so into number six now. They're like, we love you. You're the best. You did it. You killed Leo McKern. Ding dong, the witch is dead. We can't wait for you to be the boss of us.
Yeah.
But it's going to take some time. Why don't you sit in a throne with your butler?
Mm-hmm.
And number six is... barely speaks in this episode.
Yes, he has very little to say. So the last episode, there are very few characters, and number six has a lot of time. In this one, there's a lot of people running around. And yeah, number six has very little dialogue. A lot of the episode is him either silently watching or silently running around and fighting. And he's
smirking a lot. Before he gets to the running around and fighting, he's smirking a lot.
Yes.
He's very smirky, smug. And may I venture, I'm not sure about this. High out of his mind?
I don't think so, but he certainly has that kind of attitude, you know.
He seems very, very dissociated from the world around him at this point.
But you could say that that's a result of, he just went through a week of nonstop psychological torture, you know.
I'm not saying that he was secretly, you know, vaping in the elevator on the way down.
Although there's a lot of smoke coming out of those other cylinders.
That's true. There are a lot. That's true. Those cylinders... they're a little bit of the pipe organ that the butler was playing last time and a whole lot of bong.
Yeah.
But the point I'm trying to make is his brain seems a little broken at this point.
Yes.
Or he's just being incredibly cagey because he sits on that purple throne like his butt was born for it and then just smugly watches as some of the weirdest stuff I've ever seen happens on television.
Well, let's tell get us some what of this stuff. So the judge, he occasionally gets beeped messages, we assume from number one through that eye, and he can interpret them, and number two later can interpret them, but we never find out. We can't understand it.
What is your imitation or your impression of the beeped messages? What does it sound like?
I just watched this like last night, and I've already, it's like, boo, 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 like that kind of stuff, you know.
And now, Jordan, play what it actually sounds like.
Next.
Ha 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 ha
We'll let the listener decide.
I forgot we could do that. And the judge's first thing, he commands that number two be revived, which they do with a lot of beeping science fiction stuff. And they cover his face with shaving cream because when they bring him back to life and he only has a mustache.
Well, wait, hang on. This is important. First, they truck in
the entire room,
the shipping container.
That's true.
That contained the phony apartment with the bars in it from last time. And it is literally like a shipping container on the back of a truck.
Yes.
Like they were doing shipping container homes long before it was trendy in Dwell magazine. They drive that into the lair, into the cavern, and park it. And there is Leo McKern dead on the floor of that thing as number two. And some goons come up and put him on a stretcher and bring him to this tricked out barber chair,
mm-hmm.
and put shaving cream on his face and a electric hair dryer over his head.
Yes.
And then they take a long pole and they shove a baseball mitt into his face. And the president says, "Begin the resuscitation process." And then he just hangs out there for a while.
It takes a while.
Yeah, it takes a while to bring a man back to life and give him a shave and a haircut.
And give him a shave. And they have to give him a shave because, again, as we said, a year passed between these episodes, and Leo McKern shaved during that time.
Yeah, he's on another job now.
Yeah.
But we don't see that till they take him out. Right now, he's sort of in stasis.
Yeah. And while they're doing that, while he's waiting around, the judge calls for the first of what is going to be two examples of revolt. And it's the man...
No. Three.
Well... This is the... Who's the third one? Oh, yeah, that's right.
Well, yeah, it's the prisoner. It's number six.
But the two characters...
I just want to say, like, I never found this show to be scary.
Uh-huh.
I would say Once Upon a Time was the most unnerved I felt. But the time that I felt the most dread and fear was when the president of the village council of masked weirdos... says, okay, now we're going to try not one, not two, but three revolutionaries in a row. And I'm like, immediately looking at my watch, like, no, why not one? Let's get over this over with. You were right. It is going to be tedious. The ultimate transfer of power is really boring. Like, is there going to be an intermission or what? And especially when the first one takes forever.
He takes
Who's
a long
the
time.
First one?
So the first one, they release from one of the smoke capsules is number 48. And number 48, this is played by Alexis Kanner, who had an actor who had been on the show in other roles previously. This is his third appearance on the show. And he's number 48, and he has got, like, we described him a little bit at the end of the last episode. He's got a top hat. He's got a bell around his neck. He looks like he looks like a character from Cats who is a person, not a cat. He looks like he's a Godspell priest, you know.
Yeah, he's a skinny guy in a black suit with an open-necked white shirt, a bell around his neck. He's got a hippie vibe, but he's got a top hat on.
Yeah,
he looks like if the Slim Jim mascot were Abby Hoffman.
Yeah, that's a good way to describe it. Yeah, he's
that had been put through a David Bowie clone machine or something.
There's a real Ken Kesey Merry Prankster vibe about him.
Like there we go.
Yeah, like a hippie street clown. And
he speaks in this hip lingo.
Give it to me, baby.
That's it.
Give me the rest.
Give all you want to give. That's it.
That's it.
And take.
That's it.
Takes all you want.
That's it.
Take.
That's it.
Take.
Take. Take.
Take. Take.
Take. Take. Take. Take. Take.
You get the word daddy-o. You get the price. You get the name. You get the thing. And then he's really fond of one particular song.
And one point he goes, "I'm feeling real. I'm your little baby daddy." He says stuff like that, and he keeps agitating the masked man by singing and also lip syncing to the song "Dem Bones," the hip bones connected to the leg bone and all that stuff. And they play the song many times. He sings it many times. There's one great sequence that I love where he is running around the lair and they're all trying to catch him while he sings this song, and it really agitates the masked people. And what I read at one point, I think, was that they said to the people playing the guards, if one of you catches him, you get 100 pounds. And so he was really running around that set and they were really trying to catch him. But when you watch
I don't know, man, that guy leapt up some stairs, jumped from a platform onto one of the desks, did a little dance down the desk, flipped over a thing, There's some parkour to it. Or have you seen professional tag?
No.
Late at night, if you are ever in a hotel room and have actual television, it's sort of in the vibe of Ultimate Ninja Warrior.
Okay.
It's this Paniwani sport, this phony sport, but it's real. And people gather, like an audience gathers in this kind of this black box theater and surrounding a little stadium with a bunch of different obstacles in it. And grown adults play tag in it. Some of them do parkour and some of them free running and they just evade each other. It has a really weird manic energy, and that's what I felt in this moment.
Yeah, I could see that.
I would like to take a quick moment to point out that Dem Bones is a traditional spiritual. Excuse me, it's not traditional.
It's not. It's from the 20s.
It's an original song.
Yeah.
Right. It's from the 20s, composed by author and songwriter James Weldon Johnson and his brother Jay Roseman Johnson. It is inspired by the Book of Ezekiel, when Ezekiel visits the Valley of the Dry Bones. Obviously, I learned about this from the internet. It is the only acknowledgement that I can remember in any of the episodes that I've seen that there are non-white people in the world. And I know that I went into this a little bit in our very first episode, but I just want to say, this is a parable for how we are all imprisoned only if you accept that a white, relatively affluent guy is de facto humanity.
Well, it's the thing that's in a lot of what you call the mainstream media culture of the 60s and 70s, where it is, yeah, it is the idea of, hey, we're all within this system, man, that's keeping us down. Whereas for people of color, that was not a thing they had to discover. You know, that was everyday lived experience. And
yeah,
it reminds me of the first time I read, when I was in my 20s and I read Invisible Man for the first time, and I was like, what Kafka was writing about metaphorically, like that was life in America for black people for centuries, you know?
Right.
And so there's a certain, to any of these stories, there's a certain entitled privilege because the idea that your eyes have to be opened to the prison around you, you know?
I felt like, yeah, I think you put it very well. And I don't want to belabor the point because I felt like I talked about it a little bit in the first episode, which was basically, hey, Agent John Drake, what are you complaining about? You get a your prison is a cool resort. Like, this is the whitest of collar prisons.
Yeah, it's,
you know. And also, what are you upset about? What is this whole show upset about? A vague sense of alienation. Like, you know, you're not a persecuted person. That said, I had to bring it up again because I felt a little bit jarring that this beautiful white Jack Skellington motherfucker is singing Dem Bones.
Yeah.
You know, and lip syncing to the original singers too. You know, like I found that I was like, oh yeah, wait a minute. This is black American culture in a very British,
but,
and it broke for me a little bit.
I can see that
in a way that I think, you know, because like when you're insulated within the village and all of the cultural assumptions of this time, particularly the angry young man movement in books and film, where young white men in England were being portrayed as waking up to their oppression of a sort and getting mad about it. Malcolm McDowell. It was just a little bit jarring. And I don't mean this necessarily in a strictly negative way. Like I felt like it broke the world open a little bit in an interesting way to me.
Okay. Interesting. I think that there's something in there that I think is more jarring to us now than would have been at the time. Because
that's probably true.
The time, you know, just from listening to interviews with kind of rock and roll people from the time, like they talk about how there was such a sense of class oppression, and it wasn't until they heard black blues music from America that they really felt they had a way to communicate it. And that's the roots of rock and roll. Is
right.
A lot of it is
white people singing black songs and getting paid for it.
Yes, well, and especially English people finding something they connected to emotionally in black music that they couldn't find in their home culture, and then processing it into the Beatles and the Stones and the Who and all that stuff, you know?
Yeah, and you know, there's an exoticism an exoticization of this song that is being played with in this handsome, young, able-bodied, well-dressed, snappy young man who is an expression of the new generation. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
And I'm not trying to cancel anything here. I think that it is interesting. And whether or not, and invites a different interrogation today than it may have at the time. And I think I've completed my interrogation. And I think I've left it dead on the floor of the shipping container.
Well, then let me use this as a segue into another idea. Because I think that McGoohan is also in a way interrogating that. Because the judge starts talking about see, this is a little bit of eccentricity and revolt are okay, and then they become disruptive and they have to be crushed down. And it turns into this conversation where the judge is kind of taking the role of number 48's dad, and number 48 is taking the role of a baby, and say of a child. And there's a lot going on there that only came to me this time about the kind of debt that a child feels towards a person. He keeps saying, I'm your baby, I'm you, that you owe your parents everything, but you're resentful about it, and they can't really connect. And the judge is saying, like, give it to me, baby. He's co-opting the language that number 48 is using in a failed attempt to talk to him. And ultimately, this is an example that the show is giving of failed revolution. This is failed revolt, failed rebellion. And so I think McGoohan is also saying, like, this guy, whatever, but he is not doing the job. You know, this
guy thinks he's so great, but he's not so great.
Yes, exactly.
That's why he deserves to be in a steam hole.
And that's why he gets strapped back to the steam pipe for quite a while, for much of the rest of the episode.
Because he refused to answer to his number 48. He's like a younger, there's, you know, maybe the contempt that I feel for this dude is similar to the contempt that I feel for all young, handsome dudes.
It could be. And I also think
a generational anxiety about being replaced that McGoohan probably felt about an angry young youth culture that was younger than him and freer than him.
Yeah. And especially for someone like him, who, I don't know how this plays into it, was a very religious person in his private life, you know? And so I wonder if he's also looking down on the kind of revolt and freedom without meaning, you know?
That, yeah, and the co-opting of spiritualism.
Yes, and you could say that part in Ezekiel is all about someday God will make these bones walk again on the day of the resurrection when everyone comes back and is judged or whatever. And I feel like, and this episode is very much about someone, in my mind, about an individual resurrecting themselves and coming back to life, you know, coming back
literally passing through an underworld.
Yes.
And then returning to the light and living again. I think that's really interesting. I hadn't thought about that.
And I hadn't thought about that part either. And number 6, he stops number 40 at one point by referring to him as young man. It's one of the few times he talks in this sequence.
Yeah.
And I think there's
a big pause. Young man. Young man is really belabored. Also, I'll just point out, just since we're talking about young man.
Yeah.
There isn't a woman in sight.
No. Not in the entire episode, right?
Yeah. They're not prisoners in any way. This is a guy's problem.
Well, but that's the thing. I think at this point, the show has become, should I go into my major reading of the episode or no, or of the series? Because at this point,
I think we're there. You might as well lay it on me, Daddy-O. I'm your baby.
This episode, my read of this episode, sounds dumb, but I'll explain why I don't think it's dumb, is that this episode particularly, and the season in general, it's all internal. It's all going on inside number 6. And number 6 is a man. And so this battle going on with himself is between different aspects of who he is or who he has been or who he thinks he should be and those elements. Yeah. So kind of to have a woman in there, I think at this point, just as he's gone down deeper and deeper into the basements of the village, he's gone deeper and deeper into himself, where it's just the whole episode is him talking to himself essentially in different ways. And when he says young man to number 48, I think what he's saying is, you are young. You're just young. You're just a man. You don't realize that's what you are. But I'm labeling you that, and I'm recognizing this is how I look to people, and they're real. And especially how I look to people when I was young and I felt this way. And it's him putting that part of himself in check and saying, like, I'm not you anymore. You know.
I think that's a very smart reading, and I don't mean to be tendentious in pushing these particular observations about how this is all about the ennui of a white dude.
Yes.
So I'll just leave it at what I said. And the truth is, white dudes got ennui too. Like, we have, you know, all humans have an inner life, and they have, this is going to an abstraction.
Yes. So. And I think at a certain point, it's like, it's what the show's about. So like, we can't keep telling Patrick McGoohan, hey, why didn't you make a show that was about everybody when ironically,
I'm pulling him out of the grave and I'm giving him a shave and I'm resuscitating him just so I can say, let's go season 2, the other people,
the other prisoners.
One person who really enjoys Dem Bones, the butler.
Oh, he does. He really gets into it.
He's grooving to it. One point they cut to him. Angela Muscat kills it in this episode.
Yeah, he's great.
This is just the beginning of how great he is, but go on. So, right, so yes.
It's time to go to the next revolutionary. And for me, the last one, he represents revolt against a system by saying, I'm going to be the opposite of what the system tells me I should be. They bring in revolutionary number 2, which is number 2. And he now, with his shaved mustache, he's come back to life. And to me, this part represents, number two is the man who goes into a system thinking he can change it from the inside, but instead ends up being changed by it. And
right.
They've literally changed him by shaving much of his face, even though that was Leo McKern's choice, I guess, since between seasons.
Well, he might have had another role.
Yes.
I mean, he acted a lot.
That's true. He was a very successful actor who starred in his own show, which was much bigger than this one at a certain point. But
But he's got a little mustache, mm-hmm. and he's got a little nice, closely shaven little head.
And he's,
you know, his hair's nice and it's all red, and he kind of looks like Christopher Guest in Best in Show.
Yeah, yeah. And yeah. He says he feels like a new man, and there's all this audio playing of his own laughter, and everybody's laughing to it. And he shakes Six's hand, and
it's joyous. He's very happy to be alive.
He's kind of back to, it's like the fake joviality of number two in Chimes of Big Ben is kind of real joviality now. Like now he recognizes who he was in the past and going in, and his life in espionage and all that. And but they won't tell him how they brought him back, and he wants to know. And he stares down that glowing robot eye and is like, whoever you are, like he kind of has a...
Well, he acknowledges that he's never met number one.
Yes, that's right. That's
and
right.
And he decides to stare down number one and finally, having deep regret for having given himself over to power when he knew that he shouldn't have, he decides to reject number one by spitting in his HAL 9000-like eye.
And he takes off his number two badge and throws it away. And the number one eye starts to smoke as if he's doing something to it. But then he's taken away and manacled, just like number 48 in one of the steam pipes. And he goes, be seeing you, as he's lowered and laughs at it. He can kind of see the joke of what's happening.
Right.
So the judge says, revolters like number 48 and number two, they've got to be stamped out. But Six, you're of a different caliber. Like, and they salute his endless fight against the village, his inability to be changed. And they go, you're fit to lead us or go. And so this is kind of the choice that they, I guess, are offering him. And they go, here's a bunch of money. Here's a passport. Here's the key to your apartment. Here's some other stuff. You're free to go. And he keeps asking them why. And they keep responding with kind of deeper levels of like almost platitudes of like, you're a great individual. You do things your own way. You know, you're on your own and you don't care about anybody else. And
right.
It feels like this is another trap that they're setting for him, because they say, okay, give us a speech and then go. And he takes all the stuff they've offered him, the key and the cash, et cetera.
Well, hang on. Let's break down what he's got in this box.
Okay.
They give a little gift. They have a little care package.
It's a going away.
In case he wants to go.
Yeah.
It's a fairly ornate, like, cigar box. And he's got a new passport. And he's got
a new passport
a
they
million...
say can take him anywhere. So I guess
he can take him anywhere.
Even to enemy countries, you know, he can go to.
Universal access. He can go wherever he wants.
Yeah.
Traveler's checks.
That's right. They do give him traveler's checks.
It's such an antique concept, but I guess at the time, you know, that was like, all right, currency.
Mm-hmm.
A million of them. He's got a million traveler's
checks.
In
a way, it's the Bitcoin of its day. It's not backed by a government man. It's just private money, decentralized. You can use it anywhere.
He also gets a little D&D dice bag full of like gold coins or whatever his pocket change.
In case he needs to pay John Wick at some point, I guess.
Does he get a watch? Does he get a monogrammed watch or something?
He might. I don't remember, but it's possible.
Some kind of curio, some kind of little token.
Well, they should have given him a little snow globe of the village. That would have been
That would have been great. And then it should have been revealed that the whole thing was Patrick McGoohan's dream,
mm-hmm.
as he stared into the snow globe at the end of St. Elsewhere.
Yep, exactly. As all shows are.
But the Tommy Westfall-iverse.
Yeah.
But the questioning of why, I think at this point McGoohan is a little, or number six or whatever, is onto their game. It feels like a trap.
Mm-hmm.
And even if it's not a trap, it's hollow. Because I think what has been number six's point of view and the show's point of view is that no one has to earn the right to be an individual.
Yes.
Like he should not have had to prove his right to give away his number. Every episode started with, I'm not a number. So whatever they're trying to sell him on, he's like, there is no answer to why you are doing this other than power.
Yeah.
Bad faith.
If someone is granting you freedom, then you are not free. Because
they can
rescind it, or it's at their pleasure. And so
you get the sense in this moment, no matter how much he was vaping in the elevator, the former number six is not going to accept either freedom. He's not going to take the job.
Yes. This whole show is about him quitting a job. He's not going to just suddenly jump into a new one.
Yeah, exactly. That's a good point. He's not going to take the job, and he's not merely going to accept their offer of freedom passively either. And he's about to lay out his principles in a little speech.
Mm-hmm.
And what happens?
Each time he starts talking, he starts with I, and that jury of people around him, they all start chanting I, and drowning him out. And so you can't hear what he's saying. Anytime he tries to start talking, they drown him out, and it's always I. And what's funny is that, so I assumed they were just repeating him because in my reading of this episode, they're all aspects of him anyway. Anytime the word I is repeated many times. And
right.
And but in the, I think it was in the captions or in the Wikipedia page, they write it out as I-A-Y-E, like agreement, like I. Like,
yeah.
And so it could also be that they are just going through the motions of hollowly agreeing with whatever he says to kind of get him to do what they want. So whatever he says
in the captions,
there,
it was A-Y-E, yeah. I. Yeah, which is also, by the way, we were talking last time about good crossword words.
Mm-hmm.
I and nay come up a lot.
They do.
Yeah. And, you know, but we know that the captions are not perfect because they also, in this episode, credited Leo McKern's laughter as coming from number six.
Yes.
So who knows? Who knows what they were vaping in the
elevator? They were asleep at the caption switch.
Whether it's I, the letter I, right?
Mm-hmm.
Or whether it's I, A-Y-E, right? That they're saying, this is important. This repetition of I.
Yes.
So I'm going to break it down to you because I got a degree from Yale in literary theory. So
wow.
I got to earn it.
Yeah.
I got to earn
it. This is your thesis.
I wasted my time and my parents' money getting a degree in picking apart comic books, basically. And I'm still doing it, so I guess it worked out, Mom and
yeah,
Dad.
Yeah, yeah.
But what we would have been talking about in my sophomore year of college would be these things. So I is an assertion of individuality.
Mm-hmm.
It is assertion of ego, I. On the other hand, it's an assertion of mindless consent among the panel of masked weirdos behind him, like mindless conformity. Yes. We approve you unanimously, right?
Mm-hmm.
Which conformity is given in this episode by the president as the definition of civilization.
Yeah.
Conformity. Also, I is obviously bringing forward the human I. The eye of number one that is staring at them,
mm-hmm.
all of the eyes. And I think that it's easy to forget probably how provocative the level of technological surveillance in this show
yes.
freaked people out.
How beyond it, the fact that we've moved past that doesn't, it, they couldn't imagine that kind of constant video surveillance everywhere, constant eavesdropping and hearing everything. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah. And and I, of course, and I think, you know, now we take it for granted, of course, everyone's watching us and everything else. But I think that really, I think, is part of the reason why this show was so captivating and scary to people.
Mm-hmm.
This idea that there are eyes everywhere. I. The two eyes the multiple eyes in the dumb busts, the statue garden.
Yeah.
In earlier episodes, like all the eyes are very visible. It's like, we want you to know that we're watching you.
Mm-hmm.
We're not hiding these eyes, right? So there's I. I is also a Roman numeral, meaning one.
Mm-hmm.
I is six, number six. That would be VI, but you know what I'm saying. and the number one, like when in that weird cylinder over in the corner, which has that I in it, the EYEI, the HAL 9000 light eye or whatever. It kind of looks like the little mechanism that comes out of Jabba's palace to talk to mm-hmm. C-3PO at the beginning of Return of the Jedi.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, exactly. And it closes up. I love it. It's a robot who is laughing at the pain that two other robots are about to deal with. Like all the robots in good Star Wars scenes, all the robots have both personality and unpleasant personalities.
Yeah, exactly. But, you know, there's a big number one there, and it is a Arabic numeral one. But, of course, number one in Roman numerals is I.
Mm-hmm.
So who is number one is who am I?
Yeah.
Right? Who is I? Who is I? Well, we'll get to the answer to that in a minute. But the last thing I want, so that's, I mean, I bet this is all in Alex Cox's book. I bet he covered all this
stuff.
Yeah,
yeah. This is Cox 101. Yeah. IOI.
But here's what, yeah, IOI. IOI. And also there is, and I think this is just echoing, but there, I don't know that it has a direct connection, but, you know, there is an echo of die.
Yes. Yeah.
As there is an echo of why. And by the way, there's another I coming up. We'll save it for when it comes up.
Yeah, there's a surprising one coming up.
A surprise I.
And the
I just want to point this out. You know the answer to this. When was another time when our hero, our protagonist, the former number six, stated his principles and point of view and explanation for himself and his thesis for life, and you couldn't hear what he was saying? I'll tell you what, it happened more than one time.
I don't remember.
The beginning of every episode.
Oh, yeah, you're right.
To me, that was a clear echo.
You're right. I didn't even think about that, because when he's giving his reasons for resigning, all you hear is thunder in that opening credit sequence. Yeah.
Yeah. So, you know, now we have this moment where Six, for lack of a better name, is finally able to explain himself and lay down his principles. And it's drowned out. The viewer still, the mystery is maintained.
You could, and there's a certain, and you know what? I didn't even think about it until now. That's kind of a tenet of Buddhist meditation, right? Is meditation quiets the self within, so that you can actually hear yourself think. You can actually understand things.
We're here, you're like, thinking of Om.
Yeah, like that. Yeah, you're trying
not to. I.
No, but the eye of the self. You know. Anyway.
Oh, I see what you mean. And the inner eye.
And one thing, and one thing that I just find very funny about this scene is that we've watched a whole episode at this point where the guest stars on the show get to talk and talk and talk, and then the star of the episode gets up to talk, and you cannot hear him, and no one lets him say anything. He's the star of the show, and he gets drowned out. But meanwhile, number 48 and the judge and everybody, they get to go on and on and on about everything they're doing.
I mean, if he had any thought of becoming the leader of the village, arguably the new number one, or at least the new number two, at the end of this. Effort to make a speech, it's clear on his face, like, this place sucks.
Yeah.
I do not want to hang around with these dudes.
So at this point, it's like the judge tells him, come with me to go see number one. Number six lowers into the floor again. He's going even deeper down.
Right.
And he goes past a room where there's some guys in white robes looking at monitors or things. And number 48 and number two are in glass tubes marked orbit.
Orbit 48, orbit two. And then there's an empty glass tube that just says orbit.
Yeah. And
weird.
Six goes from there to a room. Is that he goes up like a spiral staircase, right?
Yes.
And he goes into a room where it's full of globes. And there's a person sitting there in a white robe with his back to him in a hood. And he's holding a glass sphere. And
he's watching television.
Yes. And he hands the sphere to number six. And we go into that glass sphere, and we see that image of the bars closing on Six's face that the episodes end with over and over again. And we hear over the audio, I. And Patrick McGoohan, he pulls off number one's mask. Number one's wearing one of those.
So wait a minute. So this particular white robe is a very special white robe, because unlike every other white robe, and with a guy with a mask, this guy's got a big label on his robe that says one.
Yeah.
This is it. This is number one. And I finally put it together in this moment that we're supposed to now be in that cylinder. We're inside that cylinder now. Like, he's gone underground.
Yeah, yeah.
Over, then up a spiral staircase into the globe room.
Yes.
Into...
Which is, to be honest, after all this high-tech surveillance technology, a room full of classroom globes of the Earth is not that impressive.
You know, if you had been vaping in the sub-basement elevator, this would be so great. You'd be like, oh.
You'd be like, look at all these worlds. Wow.
Worlds.
Are we giants?
This is proof of the multiverse. But so this is number one, presumably.
Mm-hmm.
He's watching some old clips of Patrick Magoo, and he's having a little prisoner clip show to himself. Yeah. On the other side of that screen, presumably, is that eye looking and out into the
You know what's,
the,
what's kind of funny that I never thought about is, so there's a lot of moments in the last episode and in this one where characters are watching footage from previous episodes of the show.
Yes.
And the idea that the characters in the show have become the audience, and even Number One, who is in charge of this whole thing, is just watching TV. He's just sitting back watching TV.
He's just
like,
watching TV.
That's kind of like the ultimate, another image of like TV as prison, that like even these people are kind of, when the TV is on, it's all they want to do is sit and watch it. You know, they can't ignore it. But yeah, this is...
The surveillance state is prisoner to its own desire to surveil.
Yeah, that's a good way to put it.
Anyway, so he hands over this like groovy M.C. Escher poster glass sphere.
Yeah.
To McGowan, and old Butterfingers drops it, smashes the eye or the orb or the crystal ball or the vision that it contains. I guess that means something. And then you were about to say,
then,
what
I
happens.
Forgot he this dropped
big,
it. So
this is the big Damon Lindelof moment.
It's the big reveal.
It blew his little brain when his dad made him watch it.
So he pulls off Number One's black and white mask, and beneath is kind of a chimp mask. It's like an ape face that's laughing at him. And
like a Halloween, like a bad Halloween mask of a monkey.
It not at all meant to, although when I first saw this as a little kid, for a moment I was like, oh, so it's all being run by like a super intelligent ape? I totally fell for the Doctor Who aspect of it.
It's a Planet of the Apes crossover.
Yeah, exactly.
Sure.
And then he pulls off that mask, and underneath, you guessed it, it's Number Six himself, but he is laughing maniacally. His face is so twisted with laughter that it takes a moment to recognize him, I think.
Yeah, and I read somewhere that part of the obsession with this episode was that McGowan is revealed ostensibly as Number One for 4 seconds on screen.
Mm-hmm.
And he doesn't really look like himself.
Yeah, so you could miss
He's laughing so hard, and he's laughing laughing like a baboon.
Yes.
Like a monkey. You know, he's acting in that stereotypical like ooh, 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 yeah, like a woodpecker.
Yeah.
It looks like a woodpecker with Patrick McGowan's face.
Yeah, yeah. A Magoo-pecker.
And
yeah.
People, you know, at the time
a wood Patrick.
As the time that this was aired, like no one had streaming or DVRs or anything. So if you looked away or were not watching the TV at this moment, or even if you were, you could be confused as to who that was.
Yeah, it's very possible to watch it and not realize that it's him, because it's edited so frantically at this point that it's very disorienting. And so I could see that there are probably people who got mad afterwards because they were like, what, it was him the whole time? And probably people afterwards who were like, who was it? I watched the whole show and I never even found out who that dude was. Or they would say bloke.
And of course it can't. They would say bloke.
Yeah.
Or geezer, but they can't. It wasn't him. It wasn't him. At this point, we're in the realm of pure allegory.
Yes, exactly. Yeah.
There's no way. It's not like it was a clone of Patrick McGowan or Number Six. It's not like his twin brother was in there running things. It's not like there's no. I'm sorry, Alex Cox or whoever's trying to make sense out of this thing. That's not Number Six. That's something else.
Well, it is.
Who knows what that is?
Well, it's Number Six and Number Six, because each of these, if my reading of it is, they're all him. And Patrick McGowan would talk a lot in interviews after this about, or in the few interviews I've read with him, about the idea of we're all the prisoners of ourselves. Like, we're the jailers, you know. And but it's not a, there's no universe explanation. It's all allegorical metaphor.
Well, wait, is your reading that this is all a dream or a hallucination or an inner journey?
And I would say that I think of it as an inner journey. I'll talk about that a little bit at the very end when we're done talking about it. Which
someone's been vaping in the elevator.
Which usually to me is a cop-out explanation, but I think because I see it this way, I'm like, well, this time it's not a cop-out explanation. But they chase each other around. Number One escapes into like a ceiling hatch, and Number Six goes back down those stairs, and with the help of the butler and a fire extinguisher, he manages to fight off all these baddies, and they free Number Two and Number 48. And
yeah, all of a sudden, this is what I did not remember at all.
Was the whole escape?
This was going to be an almost like an action sequence located somewhere between James Bond and Tintin and Benny Hill.
Yeah, that's a good way to describe it.
Where he's basically like rolling a bowling ball and knocking down a dozen white-robed, masked, like, cultists. But the beautiful thing that happens here is the butler turns.
Yeah.
How does number six know that the butler is on his side? And what does he read in that beautiful Angelo Muscat face? Because when you see Muscat reach for the fire extinguisher, you know it. You know that he's on his side.
Yes, there's no doubt about it. Yeah.
I'm not asking these questions like, why weren't we shown when he turned? I was just like, I loved that all of a sudden it was just known.
And I think that's one of the things that makes this art as opposed to like a well-crafted story is that it's something that he knows it and we know it right away. There's no confusion. We can tell right away, oh, the butler's on his side. And in my understanding of it, it's like as soon as he recognizes that he himself is the problem, he's unmasked number one, then the butler, who's the only other consistent element throughout the entire series, it's like, oh yeah, this is part of me. I should have been relying on this. This is inner strength I didn't notice before, and now I know that I have it, you know?
Yeah, yeah, because this guy's just been, I mean, this guy's been pooped on by, you know, by everyone for all, just been serving up. He was, at the beginning of Once Upon a Time, he just got yelled at for the first scene.
For serving breakfast, for doing something nice.
He laid out the breakfast, and then he had to have it taken away. Then he spent a week in a room with these two freaks.
Yeah, yeah.
Didn't even get a break.
He's the real prisoner. He's the real hero of this story, yeah.
And you know that there had to have been, I don't know why I didn't think about this myself, but there had to have been a whole legion of dudes with theories who were for sure certain that the butler was number one.
Yes, exactly. Like the theory about how in James Bond, Blofeld is really the cat, and he takes over the minds of men and makes them dress the same. But the cat's really the bad guy. But
I've never heard that before, but I believe it.
I'm sure there were people who were like, yeah, like, oh, well, it's going to turn out to be the butler. It has to be. And the butler did it. It was all there ahead in front of us the whole time.
And then when it was revealed that McGoohan was under there, I'm sure that they just stayed up all night, you know, smoking their hand-rolled cigarettes at the pub, trying to talk their way out of what the show showed them, which is like, all your theories are dumb. The answer is impossible. There are no answers. We are prisoners of our own minds.
Well,
you can't take this serious. There is no in-world explanation.
Yes.
It was not the butler.
There's not intended to be, and there isn't one. But they would go, they would write on their blogs, which at the time were just journals, and then they would tweet about it, by which I mean they would just write something on a piece of paper and throw it out a window and hope somebody just came along and read it.
They would just bother their spouses with their ideas. Yeah.
So the 6 and 2 and 40, at this point, it's a big, like you said, James.
Oh, give them all, let's do the rundown, okay? Because all of a sudden, we got a gang of heroes here.
Yeah.
We got the prisoner and his priz pals.
Yeah.
This is a team. Don't just rattle them
off.
Sorry,
yeah, there's...
We got number 6, the new number 1.
Mm-hmm.
He is not a number. We'll call him Johnny Not a Number. He's the leader of the gang. We got this incredible butler who's just wailing on people with a fire extinguisher.
Mm-hmm.
Either he's giving them the hose again or he's bonking them on the head with the with the canister. Then we got our man, Leo McKern.
Mm-hmm.
He feels like a new man. He's got a cool new haircut. He's looking great and he's helping out. He's now fully on the side of Not a Number. And then even I have to love Jim Dandy, tap dancing opera fanatic.
He's very much the gambit of the group. He's the character who he's a member of the team.
I was just getting to like him.
He thinks he's great. He's terrible, but he's I actually kind of like him a little bit just because I love the way he kind of dances and runs around. But so
you know, here's this individual to the point of isolationist. This guy who has refused to trust anyone, who's been taught not to trust anyone from his previous job and his time in the village, and then automatically feels a bond of trust with these misfits and these oddballs, the priz pals. it's such a new mood to the show, and it's such an interesting choice.
Yes, and it's from this moment on that the show reaches this kind of giddy sense that it has never had before. They're fighting to All You Need Is Love. They're just shooting people left and right. It's a little on the nose, but...
Yeah, that felt a little on the nose. I mean, honestly, them picking up, you know, machine guns and having a shootout, you know, I took that as being satire of James Bond.
Yes, I think so too. I think
it's definitely a whole new mood.
Yes, I think the joke there is the idea that this would ever solve a problem. basically. Right. It's ludicrous. Yeah.
You know what it reminds me of a little bit? What the end of Brazil.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. The fantasy,
you know what
end.
I mean?
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And like you kind of half expect, and I'm glad they don't do this spoiler for both Brazil and this episode. Like you kind of half expect that once he gets his Priz pals together and he finally learns to trust other people and he learns that he can kill his enemies and actually escape, that they're going to then cut to him, you know, with a bullet hole in his head, having a fantasy or whatever.
Or in a straitjacket or something.
In a straitjacket, like, I'm the crazy, you know, I'm a prisoner of my own mind.
But in Brazil, it's a fantasy of escape. And in this, to me, it's a fantasy that does allow him to escape. So it is kind of, it's kind of right. Similar in that way. But yeah, there it is.
But they don't cut back to him, like, back in the embryo room.
No, they don't.
Like, drooling.
Well, he lost at degree absolute. I guess I'm still number two. Like, we don't have that. Instead, everyone...
I love that. I love it's not that, because that's what I would have predicted it was going to be, based on my...
And that's kind of... And it feels like... That feels like such a... I mean, I think it works in Brazil, but here it would be such a boilerplate, kind of cynical, you know, thing.
Right.
But everyone evacuates the village by helicopter, because... Number six has also set all these dials.
Brazil? Can I tell you something about Brazil?
Sure.
You know what a better title for that movie would be?
What's that?
Bummer.
It is a bummer. You should watch the studio cut. It's on the Criterion Collection. It has a happy ending. It makes no sense. So number six has already set all these dials that are going to set off a rocket that the number one canister is.
The number one canister is a big old rocket.
It's a big rocket. Everyone's evacuating the village.
It's like an Apollo 11 style rocket.
Yeah.
We only saw part of it in the cavern. I mean, talk about James Bond.
It's very James Bond, and also very Spaceballs.
They've got a rocket in their pocket.
Because this is the part where everyone is just scrambling to escape, and it's like the scene in Spaceballs where they're evacuating, and there's like a bear and things like that. Because this is where, like, you're talking about the guys in scuba suits on little motorbikes. Like, that's all here, and it's chaos.
So the Priz pals are inside the rocket, and they're Priz, I'll just call him Priz now at this point.
Yeah, yeah.
He's a superhero. Priz is like hitting all these dials to these weird names and so forth. And the president is Priz versus Priz. The president, the guy in the judge's robes who was in charge before, is out there in the cavern going, uh-oh, rocket's about to take off. Evacuate everything.
Yeah.
And you watch the entire village evacuate, screaming villagers, helicopters going everywhere. And of course, down very narrow cavernous tunnels, dudes in scuba suits on scooters, scuba scoots, we call them, just like banging into each other trying to get away.
Yeah, this is way beyond orange alert. This is the worst alert they could have.
His worst alert.
But our heroes, the Priz pals, they have gotten into the jail cell on the back of the truck that number two died in, and the butler just drives them away from the village as this rocket launches out and Rover surfaces and
I didn't like this
and kind of dissolves. And this is the one part that is a little too silly for me, is they start playing a Carmen Miranda song called I Like You Very Much. And I assume they're only using it because it says I over and over again. But it sounds
ridiculous.
It took
ridiculous. Me a while to figure out why they were using it. Yeah. But it's I Like You Very Much.
This is a song from the movie That Night in Rio from 1941. And
it gives it all a Looney Tunes quality.
Yes.
You know? And
it's so silly at that moment. Yeah.
Let's just not pass over Rover. I mean, this is it for Rover.
Yeah, Rover comes up and deflates and kind of melts and is destroyed.
My impression is he comes up and gets just burned out by the exhaust of the rocket.
That's what Wikipedia says, too. It's not, it wasn't super clear to me that that's what happened.
No.
But
no.
There's part of it that could, since this is all allegorical, it could be that Rover recognizing that it has failed self-destructs. You know, who knows?
It was burned up by the exhaust of the rocket. It's pretty clear to me.
Okay. Well,
and you know what? I feel bad for Rover, because Rover, I like you very much. I really do. I like that Rover.
That's sweet, yeah. For a giant balloon that just eats people, it's very lovable, you know?
He's a huggable killer.
Mm-hmm. The butler drives them in this truck down a highway. They're all dancing in the back.
Do you think our listeners have fully grokked? Oh, I guess they've watched the episode.
Hopefully,
or they're about
to.
So they've grokked, if I may say.
Yeah.
They've grokked that they're...
We're talking about the prisoner. It's okay to use grok.
They climbed into this diorama of a middle-class apartment with bars in the front.
Mm-hmm.
It's on the back of a truck, and they just drive down a tunnel and right out of the village.
They smash through a gate, and they're right out of the village, and they are now on the highway. Our heroes are dancing in the back, and they pass like a Grey Poupon-type Englishman.
Grey Poupon guy.
in a car, and he turns and sees them and is like, ooh. And then, and we see a sign, they're on the A20 motorway. They have driven right from the village straight into the heart of England. And the idea that and I love this because
when they pass Grey Poupon guy in his with his fancy suit with his bowler hat on, the picture of, you know, 1960s British conservatism, and this truck passes being driven by a person of short of stature, a bunch of oddballs in a cage dancing around like lunatics.
Yeah.
You know, I think the social commentary there is pretty clear.
I think so. We've passed symbolism into super symbolism at that point.
Right.
But the idea that all this stuff was made earlier about, we don't know where the village is. Maybe it's somewhere near Romania. It might be over here. It was just it's all allegorical anyway. So yeah, it's just in the middle of England. It's where he lives.
I mean, there's this whole Mandela effect, I think, that everyone, including myself, thought, of course, it's an island.
Yeah.
You know, why wouldn't it be? It's referred to in so much of popular culture as an island, you know, when people think about the prisoner. But other than England itself being an island, the village itself is not an island.
Yeah.
This phantasm that we're watching now.
And it's
actually fairly close to London.
Yes. And within driving distance. And it reminds me of, there's a scene in one of the issues of the Forever People that we mentioned earlier on, either this episode or the last one, where the heroes are in a torture chamber and they're screaming, but they're behind glass at a Disney type amusement park, and it makes it look like they're laughing. And I just love the idea of the most evil people, their headquarters are hidden in plain sight, pretty much like in a theme park that people go to. And so the idea that this village is within driving distance of London, I think is just fantastic.
Right.
They stop on the road to let 48 get out, and he starts to hitchhike. And a funny joke, I think, is funny, is that they keep returning back to him through the credits, and no one ever picks him up.
No one wants him. Oh my God.
And
can you imagine how unbearable it would be to go on even a 2-mile drive with him?
Horrible. Horrible.
Like, he's like, hey, daddy-o, mind if I sing you some spirituals?
Waving his
little
bell
at you. It's hard for me to get into your little car with my big hat.
They go into London and they let number two out, and he walks over to Parliament and hears the chimes.
He walks right into the halls of power.
And the music at this point is very like, it's bum, 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 da, 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 da. There's this like kind
triumphant.
Of like triumphant, carefree music that you just wouldn't expect at this point. And this English Bobby in the distance approaches number six, and we just see number six explaining something to him with these big hand motions. And it's like, what could he, I love the idea, what could he possibly be saying to him at this point?
This is absolutely my number one. You know how I always said, what am I going to see in the rest of this episode what am I going to see in the rest of the series that's going to be as visually innovative and arresting as any frame of the first episode? Like, what more can you show me?
Yeah.
And this was with all of the surreal hokey pokey that we just went through, none of which was themed to the village at all. It was all journey through the underworld, completely dark, a new world than what we've experienced over the rest of the series. None of the village, none of Port Marion, nothing. I did not expect my number one favorite image would be this part at the end where you are in natural light in London.
In actual London. Yeah. On the streets.
Actual natural London. Foreground is the butler just standing there watching. Deep background is number six, who has just waved goodbye to number two, who didn't bother to even say goodbye.
No, like, the enemy, number two just... the enemy that he pushed to his death in a battle of wills in the previous episode, he watches him walk to his office and waves goodbye to him.
Yeah. We come back to this, like, the camera's basically on the ground.
Yes, it's very low.
Foreground is the butler. Deep background now is number six. A bobby, that's what they call a uniform police officer in the UK. A bobby, a copper, walks by the butler, gives him kind of look, then walks up to number six in the deep background. And again, it's number six is speaking. We don't hear him.
Yeah.
And the gestures that, like, what is he saying? Is he explaining what happened to him? What is, we'll never know. It's this wonderful mystery. Like, what could he possibly be saying to this Bobby? And of course the Bobby's like, all right, governor.
And the Bobby just lets him walk off. Like, he's just, he's probably confused. And then,
well, he wasn't doing anything wrong. He was just sitting, he was just standing there outside of Parliament.
Well, I always assumed that the Bobby's asking him why he left that truck there. But,
that's true. But, yeah, that might be.
But then we go to, I think, one of my favorite shots in the whole series, which is number six goes back to the butler, and the two of them, hand in hand, run over to a double-decker bus.
I couldn't believe it.
And it's just so beautiful. This is the part I almost cry at every time. It's so joyous. And so it's like the end of The Graduate before things get sad again, or like something, like I said earlier, about Out of Hard Day's Night, like just the two of them feeling so free and hand in hand together, like the heroes of this show, as they go to, as they go to the bus, and they, the butler takes six to his car, and six drives the butler to his house, to number six's house. And the butler goes into the house, and it has one of those electric doors like in The Village, where it opens on its own and it closes on its own.
Which is scary. Because now you're like, well, wait a minute. It's a very subtle thing. And I think it's just the right touch, because it's not, it's in no way saying like, he didn't escape after all. This is fake London.
Yeah.
No way London would have doors that open automatically like this. It's just enough. And the butler goes into number six's old home, and number six drives away.
And we see there's just a few last shots. So we see he drives off. We see number two now in full Parliament bowler hat, you know, regular dress.
He's been reacclimated to.
He has been absorbed by another system that he thought he could change from the inside, maybe, but, you know, it's just become one of them. And we see number six driving, and he drives into the first shot from the opening credits, the first time we see him after the lightning in the sky, where it's just him looking at you, is there thunder? I think so. And it goes to black, and then to the opening credits or the end credits. And it's, so this is my, and I always find this moment, every time I've seen it, I found it like transcendent in some way, that we're brought back to this moment we've seen so many times before, but it means something different to us now. And this is my partly pretentious, partly not pretentious read of what's going on in the series, if you'll permit me, if you'll indulge me.
Oh, I'll permit you. I'll be back. Come back in a year.
No, you don't need to do that. Usually I hate these kinds of explanations, but I like to think that this whole situation, this is what he is thinking about on his drive to work. He's going into work, and he's thinking, I want to quit my job. And the whole series, it to me, and maybe it's just because I feel like I'm at a turning point in my personal life right now. John and I have talked about this off microphone, that I'm going through kind of one of those, I'm 40 years old, I'm about to turn 41. I'm going through one of those, who am I, what am I doing with my life type phases. Of course, my life is fantastic, and I just have to recognize
you're talking about
that
me,
emotionally.
John? John Hodgman. And you have talked about it?
Yes, okay. Yeah. Me and number John. But
I don't remember that conversation.
Oh, boy.
Right. Well, I bet we had it.
Really putting me in my place. But to me, it is, number six is, or the prisoner, because he's at the end of the credits, he's just listed as prisoner now. They don't say number six, and they don't say Patrick McGowan. But anyway.
That was breathtaking to me.
In a good way or a bad way?
Good. I mean, of all of the constant reiteration, it's like, we're never really free, we're all prisoners of a different kind. The show's called The Prisoner, 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 prisoner. Like, I felt like every iteration of that kind of sophomoric cynical worldview, like we're all trapped, blah, 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 even at our most free. None of it hit as hard for me as in that weird closing credits. Weird only insofar as it had not been done in the show before.
Yes, where people get their names up and, yeah.
The Priz Pals have all got off the bus, as it were. They're splitting up after the ultimate heist. And first you see Top Hat number 48 trying to in vain to thumb himself a ride, and they just show his the name of the actor.
Yeah, Alexis Kanner.
Alexis Kanner. What is his name?
Alexis Kanner.
Alexis Kanner.
Yeah.
And then when number two is going into Parliament, Leo McKern. When the butler is standing by the door, I think he's the last one too.
I think he is. Yeah,
comes first, but
it says Angelo Muscat.
Yeah, it just says Angela Muscat. And, you know, when you do that in a credit sequence, it's like these are the most famous actors in the world. Do you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. Like, it's like when you've watched an epic movie from the 60s or 70s, and they'll just like do a thing where like flashback Michael Caine.
Yeah.
Or, you know, like, and then you see Priz driving away in his new old car from a far distance. And it doesn't even say the prisoner. It just says prisoner.
Yeah. And it doesn't say Patrick McGoohan. It just says prisoner.
It just says prisoner. Doesn't say his name. Doesn't say the prisoner. It just says prisoner. And I don't know why that got me. Still gets me.
Yeah.
Like, it's like, woof. That was a woof.
And
then they cut to your final scene where it turns out that the whole series was his daydream as he's driving to work. And
so I don't know. So
then he got distracted and he drove into a pole and died.
That's exactly what it is. No. So there's some, I've read readings of this that say, oh, well, this is telling me that everyone's a prisoner and they can never escape from life. And so
right. It's
a cycle and it's all going to happen again. And I think that's such a bleak reading and it so fights the joy at the end of this series that it turns that joy into such a poisonous joke on the viewer that I find it so unpleasant. That would be if they
came back to him and he's drooling in the embryo.
Yes,
room.
Exactly.
That's not what this is.
No.
I agree with you.
And so to me it is.
So what is it?
I think all the things we know about him are probably true. He's a spy. He does work that he thought at one point was important. Maybe he thought he could go, and he's been each of those people. When he was young, he was an eccentric and tried to rebel that way. Then he decided, I'm going to go into the system and I'm going to try to change it. And instead it changed me. And he's going into work. And I think the whole series, he's saying, I don't want to do this. I need to take responsibility for my own life. I can't be just doing what authorities tell me. I have to think about who I am, what I'm doing on this earth. Who am I helping? Who am I hurting? I have to take responsibility for myself. And that means leaving this job. And he imagines him going in angrily, throwing down his resignation, all that, and being kidnapped. And everyone's saying, why did you resign? Why did you resign? And what he's really asking himself is, why am I resigning? What's the reason? Like, when they ask me, what can I tell them? And I think by the end of this series, he realizes, I don't have to tell them. I don't have to have a reason. I'm myself. I don't want to do this. If I'm going to be responsible for me, I have to figure out who I am. And that means I'm not doing this anymore. And they don't need to know about it. It doesn't matter. And so rather than the childish rebellion of, hey, Dad, you want to do this? Well, I'm going to do that. Beep, bop, doop, zip, zap. Or the kind of fooling yourself rebellion of, I'm going to join the system and I'm going to change it from the inside, when that almost never happens. Instead, it is this more mature rebellion of, I'm going to remove myself as much as I can from this system to figure out what I can actually do. Like, that's my optimistic read of it.
So the Kalen reading is basically, you got to look out for number one.
Ugh, boy. Ugh. Ugh. Ugh.
Got to look out for number one.
But I think the reason, if I can be autobiographical again, the reason I kind of think of it this way is,
by the way, I don't mean to diminish
I understand.
Reading. I think that...
No, that was too good a gag, it was too good a gag.
No, it wasn't that good. they call it a gag for a reason. But I think that... I like your reading very much, and I think that it comports exactly right with, and it articulates in ways that I couldn't, it comports exactly correctly with the feeling of the end of the show. Like, the show wasn't tricking you.
Yes.
It wasn't showing you this James Bond stuff because it condescends to you and James Bond and those expectations. Like,
it's not like the movie Sucker Punch where they're like, isn't this the kind of thing you like? Like,
yeah, you're stupid for liking this.
You're
I'm
stupid.
Smart.
You love seeing girls with short skirts shooting people. And it's like, while you're watching the movie, you're like, I don't like this. This is not enjoyable to me.
Is that what Sucker Punch is about?
Sucker Punch is a series of scenes of women, scantily clad young women in incredibly violent kind of action or fantasy or science fiction movie scenes. And then at the end, it's like, yeah, they've all been lobotomized in a sanitarium or something. And it's like, I didn't make this movie. Like, don't put this on me.
It's like all those comedians say, I'm just saying what everyone's thinking, but they're too afraid to say. It's like, oh, I don't want to take, I'm not thinking, don't put your thoughts in me.
Yeah, yeah. And so I think the James Bond stuff at the end is not, here, dummies, this is what you like, take it. Isn't it stupid? It's instead, we're going to take this and we're using the thing you think to do something that's going to show you something different. You know, that's going to, it's for a different meaning. And watching this took me back to the moment I decided to leave The Daily Show, when there were a lot of good reasons for me to stay. It was a very well-paid job. It was a very stable job. And
High status.
It was very, I enjoyed doing it for the most part. And my parents liked bragging about it.
You were very good at it.
Thank you. And I felt good at it. Yeah. Ultimately, the reason I came down to ultimately was like, I don't want to do this anymore. And I remember talking to my wife and I was like, the only reasons I can think of not to do it are emotional. And she's like, those are good reasons. She was like, I don't want you to go and do a job you're not enjoying every day and then come home and I have to deal with you. Like, that's a good enough reason for me to leave. And I feel like that's this number six I'm projecting onto him, but I think he's coming to a similar realization. If it's not right for me to do this thing, then that's all the reason I need to stop doing it. And of course, that's from a privileged white man in England position. You know, no one's forcing him to do it. And economically, it seems like he has a nice house and everything like that. He doesn't need to. But that the idea that the only way to break out of that prison of the self and that prison of society is to kind of be honest with yourself and take responsibility for yourself.
I agree with you, and I think that that's quite right. And I don't even know, and you know, I'm Johnny Woke over here, and I don't even know that...
Johnny Wokeman.
I don't feel a need to preface this with a lot of, like, I know it's privileged, but...
Oh, okay.
I
mean,
we all, you know, one of the things, as someone who has also changed, I don't even put it as simple as careers, life paths.
Mm-hmm.
It's very challenging to know what makes you happy. Not superficially happy, or not a definition of happiness that you has been culturally drummed into you or drummed into you by your family, an expectation of what should make you happy. Like, it takes a lot of quiet and thoughtfulness to tune into what makes you deeply happy.
Mm-hmm.
And everyone deserves to do that work, whether you're doing it with a therapist or on your own, you know? But I think it's important to recognize it's not easy to know what makes you deeply happy. Everyone deserves to figure out what makes them deeply happy. And if they are able to change their life to move into the direction of what makes them deeply happy, it takes a lot of courage to do it, even when there isn't money on the line,
mm-hmm.
you know? And I think in that sense, there really is a question of who is number one. Who is I?
Yeah.
Who is I? You know, what do I need? And really the answer for why you would resign from a situation that is unhappy for you, whether that is a professional situation, whether you're a super spy, whether you're in a friendship that is no longer working, whether you're in a partnership that's no longer working, whatever it is, the reason to resign and step away may simply be it doesn't make me happy
yeah.
anymore. And that that inner happiness can change. You know, like, there was a long time when I was profoundly happy on stage. And for whatever reason, you know, performing my imitation of comedy on stage. And I'll still go out and have a fun time every now and then, you know, goofing around with friends on stage or doing the live Judge John Hodgman or something like that. But like, when I think about going and doing a weekly show at Union Hall or whatever, some of the best times of my life, but there is no urge in me to do that now.
Mm-hmm.
That is not what makes me deeply happy has shifted and evolved. And I have to listen to that and figure out the next thing. And it is not something that I owe. I think I'm echoing a lot of what you were saying, primarily because I didn't think about it in those terms. So thank you. I think it's true to the series. I think your reading is very, very thoughtful and correct. But when you were talking about it, you were mostly talking about you. So now it's time for me to talk. The only difference is, I think it's about me.
Isn't it? Yeah, here's where you're misreading the show.
But I think that it is really true. And as much as I've been a real stick in the mud about what a bratty jerk Priz is throughout this series, how he's just like got an oppositional defiant disorder, how he's just like, no, I'm not going to mm-hmm. tell you anything. I'm going to put the radio in the refrigerator.
I want soup. Okay, here's some soup. You're giving me soup? Then forget it. I want Jello.
Yeah, to me, that's as annoying as a guy in a top hat who wears a bell around his neck and sings songs.
Sings stambones all the time, yeah.
Yeah, exactly. But I do think that that was an immature him, and the mature him that is driving away is the one who is able to say what we should all be able to say. It's like, I don't owe you an explanation for my happiness.
Yeah, and also I don't need to define...
What do you care?
And I don't need to define myself against you. I can define myself by me.
Right.
And yeah, what do you care? And so I imagine he goes into the boss's office, and instead of yelling and slapping his resignation down and hitting the desk so hard that he breaks a tea saucer, that instead he goes in and he says, yeah, I'm resigning. I quit. Thank you. And then just
And the boss leaves. Is like, I can't hear you because of all the thunder.
It's so loud. Why did you have to quit during a storm?
Why am I hearing thunder in my office in the third sub-level of a parking garage? That's how they say it over there.
Yeah, it's such a depressing office that his boss works in. So it must grim. Be. It's such a cut-rate spy agency. Like So Patrick McGoohan, he'll say in interviews, he says stuff about like that. I think he didn't see the ending that way. He saw it as we're all prisoners all the time, and we can never be truly free.
I mean, I don't know if McGoohan ever claimed that he understood it, but I do think that this is a real rebuke to people who feel that things always have to be understood.
Yes, I agree.
Like, you know what I mean? Like, it's a TV show. It's a fantasy. It's a thought. You know what I mean? It's not something that needs to be wrestled down into the ground and explained and mapped out and understood. And if you try to, you're going to fail. I don't care how many books you write afterward. No offense to anyone who wrote books. I can understand why you
want
to write.
Alex Cox in particular, no offense.
No. I'm sure he's great. I mean, I'm fascinated. He's terrific. I love him, and I'm not putting this on him. I'm just like, the world itself is intriguing, and you kind of want to hear more stories about the village. That's fine. But work that you're doing to try to make this make sense is kind of pointless.
I think you're right.
It's not.
Yeah, it's meant to inspire thought in you rather than to give you something that you just take away from it cleanly and then that's it. You put it down eventually, you know?
Yeah. And you know, I offer that as a defense of those other shows where mystery shows where you want a clear answer. You don't really want that, a clear answer. Like for all of these mystery shows, the reason you're watching it is mystery.
Mm-hmm.
There's a difference. I don't remember who said this. It's a woman was talking about writing film and television. If you're out there listening, let me know who you are. I don't even remember where I read this. I'll track it down one of these days, but it stayed with me, which is that when you're writing for film or television or whatever, there's a difference between confusion and mystery. There's a lot of weird TV out there, but there's a difference between confusion and mystery. Confusion is obviously just confusion. It's like, who's this person? Why did that just happen? What's going on there? But mystery may have those elements, but it's a journey. It's a desire to go forward, to see what's around that corner or down that hatchway, or what is the sub-basement below this sub-basement. You want to keep going forward. And obviously there is this tremendous human impulse to solve the mystery. But do you really want it to be solved? There is no solution that's ultimately going to be acceptable fully, I don't think. And always when you come to the end of a mystery novel, the solution is kind of like the least fun part. It's just like where everything makes sense. It just feels like a letdown. I'd much rather have my mysteries reflect what real life is like, where we're going through, where every day is a mystery. We don't know what's going to happen around the corner of this day or this week or this year or whatever. There's no explanation for any of this stuff that we're in. So why would you expect it at the end of your TV show? The Prisoner is the name of the TV show. Any other final thoughts?
No, I said earlier I was worried going into these episodes that I was going to watch them and be like, oof, this is the thing that I really felt special about all this time and that I made John go back and watch. But watching them again, I was so, like I said, so pleasantly surprised that they hit me, if anything, even harder than before, and that they, you know, reignited my faith in this series as a thing worth talking about to people. And I was talking to my wife after we watched the last two episodes together, and she watched the other episodes for this podcast that we watched together, and she was still grappling with it. And then the next day, she was like, I'm still thinking about that show. Like, I'm still kind of thinking about it. And I thought that's the ultimate victory of the show, that instead of something that we watched it and we were like, that was fun, and then it passed through our system cleanly and with minimal wiping, that instead it was something that was still kind of sitting in her head and making her think. And I referred to her. I was like, I think this series might be the most expensive therapy session in the history of the world. Like Patrick McGoohan.
For McGoohan.
Yeah, for McGoohan. Yeah. That Patrick McGoohan was just like, you're going to give me some money? Okay, I'm going to work through some issues I have in public on TV. And I think it's really beautiful for that. That so rarely, this will be a final thought, because television is such a committee-driven industry, and it happens in installments, and you have to
Thanks.
That it's so rare that you get to see a television show that feels so much like a voice speaking personally in the way that you get in novels or plays or songs.
Right.
And I think this is, even just for that, this is such a special show for that someone had the opportunity to do that so if not always clearly, then so completely.
And since in the year 2022, there is so much television, and there are no more novels or plays or songs or movies. There's only television.
Only television.
There's only 10-episode streaming series. It's important to think about how you can make television an expression of a personal point of view or struggle. Elliot, I only have one other final thought. You don't write us letters about the episodes that we didn't watch and talk about.
Don't tell us why we were wrong not to cover this one or that one, The Girl Who Was Death or Free For All or anything.
Yeah. The show is over. the prisoner is over. Be Potting You is over. Why did we not investigate all of those episodes? There are logistical reasons. Elliot, as you know, is undertaking a number of new careers, as am I. I definitely felt no intrinsic desire to watch all of those middle episodes, especially now that we know the history of the show is like it was meant to be 7 episodes and then became, 17. So how many of them are essential? I'll allow that mystery to stand. I'm sorry that if you felt let down that we didn't watch every and discuss every episode, because I know there are people out there who love The Prisoner, and the people who love The Prisoner tend to be nerdy completists like myself. I appreciate your frustration, but I am glad that we got to share this time together, Elliot, you and me, mm-hmm. in this prison of our own making, and with you, all of the listeners. And I think you will join me in thanking Jordan Cowling for doing another incredible job producing and editing this program. You know, Quad Squad forever, Priz Pals for life. I mean, and I want to thank Damon Lindelof for talking with us about his own memories of The Prisoner. And of course, we got to acknowledge Paul F. Tompkins for once again singing our theme song, which we're about to hear. Anything you want to say before Paul starts singing that theme song?
We'd also like to thank all the Max Fun listeners, and especially Max Fun pledgers who have supported us and supported the network and made this show and made my forcing John to watch these limited episodes of The Prisoner possible. Without you, I never could have gassed him in his house and stuck him in a hearse and driven
drugged
him to the village.
Into this podcast. Yeah. thank you so much, Max Fun members, supporters, and listeners. You not only made this podcast possible, you also made it an obligation. But honestly, I mean, I hope you know how we all at Maximum Fun feel about the Max Fun community, the listeners, listener members, supporters, and everyone else. We're so glad to be on this island with you.
Mm-hmm. Thank you very much for joining me on this journey deep into the prison of the self. And even though we won't be potting you again, listeners, in the larger, more universal sense, we will be potting you at some point because The Prisoner still exists for us all. And John, if you'll take my hand, I see a double-decker bus over there across the street.
Oh, it's one of those old ones where you can just leap on the back.
You just jump on the back. Let's run to it now. Let's run to it.
Okay, let's go.